Okay, good afternoon, everyone. We want to bring the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy to order. We do not have a quorum, but we're going to start with House File 2182. Representative Levon. Well, welcome, and why don't you begin by introducing, we cannot move the bill, so why don't you introduce it by just telling us a little bit about your bill, and then we'll move to your testifiers.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My bill is 2182, and I have with me today two testifiers, and we will do our best to keep our testimony short so that you can move on to the other bills. I know you have a full calendar today. House File 2182 is truly a workforce shortage program pilot. We are here today with the people who are touched most by this program, and it is to fill the need of personal care attendants as we go forward in Minnesota and to fill this important need. This is to develop a pilot project establishing the Minnesota Direct Care Service Corps. It will be done in conjunction with Winona State and through their, Health Force Minnesota program. And it, as you know, Winona State is a center of excellence within our state university system, and they are well-equipped and qualified to do this pilot program. I would like to introduce the two testifiers that I've brought with me today, Diane Drost and Kim Cry. Each of them will give you a brief testimony as to why this program is important, and then we'll be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Before our testifiers begin, why don't we move this? Why don't we have a quorum present.
Oh, perfect.
So may I get a motion to approve the minutes for March the 20th?
So moved.
Representative Loeffler. Moves approval of the minute for March 20th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March the 20th are approved. Thank you. So the chair now moves House File 2182 to be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. To the testifiers, please introduce, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and who you're with and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Diane Drost, and I am a member of Women Staying Strong, and I'd like to thank Chairman Moran and the committee members for allowing me to come in and testify. Not only am I a member of Women Staying Strong, I'm also a member of the Olmstead Subcabinet Cross-Agency Direct Care and Support Workforce Shortage Working Group. And here comes my daughter. We are here to ask for support for this pilot program. Some of the issues that we've come up with between the two groups is we find that there's college students and their families that are struggling with the high cost of college. This debt that they have is significantly impacting their lives after graduation, but also affects decisions made regarding part-time work while they're in college. At the same time, the state of Minnesota is facing a critical workforce shortage of people willing to work as personal care assistants in in-home settings for people with significant physical disabilities. This is due not only to the workforce shortage, but also because people living in their own homes are unable to offer higher salaries and other recruitment incentives such as scholarships, tuition reimbursement, loan forgiveness that many other larger organizations are able to provide. Home care workers work in isolations with little recognition for the important work they're doing. And today, OPCA can actually work in home care with less needy people than my daughter, for example, and receive the same pay. So the solution we came up with was this pilot program. We feel that if we offer students additional incentives, we may be able to recruit from them once more. Students are already being recruited on college campuses across the state. DHS and state universities are holding sessions where they are giving students the opportunity to learn about careers in human services, but also part-time work while they're in college. Smaller independent home care providers have more difficulty in recruiting because they cannot compete with the incentives that are offered by many of these large organizations. So in summary, we really need to act now. There's a sense of emergency in our community. Many people are being forced out of their homes into hospitals and into nursing homes and assisted living because they simply can't get the help they need in their homes. So please support this pilot program project. Thank you for allowing me to share this information.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier, please welcome to the committee.
Please
introduce yourself, who you will, and proceed.
My name is Kim Pry, and I'd like to thank Chairman Moran and the committee for hearing us today. My introduction to PCA services happened when our family moved my husband's bachelor uncle into our home to recover after he suffered a debilitating stroke. Because of the difficulty in hiring a caregiver, we decided that the best option was for me to resign my job and provide the 24/7 care ourselves. After our uncle was able to return to supported independence, I began my career as a personal care assistant, or PCA. And I loved every minute of being a part of keeping individuals in the community. Most caregivers do not make enough money to obtain and retain safe housing, have access to reliable transportation, afford health care or higher education, support dependents, or save for retirement. Despite my own commitment to the work of caregiving and the deep satisfaction I found in that field, I found that it was necessary for me to leave that field in order to meet the needs of my family and go back to a traditional employment setting. In my current role at a healthcare facility, it is common for clients to cancel and forfeit the care that they need due to lack of PCA assistance. Currently, caregivers in the state of Minnesota find themselves in a position of making a decision to take care of themselves or to pursue a career in caregiving. This is not acceptable. Nobody wins. Not the PCAs who love their jobs, not the clients who need the services to live independently, not the families who are left to pick up the pieces when everything falls apart over and over again due to the lack of a stable, quality workforce. Creating opportunities within this particular workforce can improve the lives of scores of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do you have any other testifiers?
Do you want to say anything?
Hi.
All right. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself.
My name is Rob Woodlick. I'm a person with spinal cord injury and member of Get Up Stamped Care Paralysis. You know, members, Madam Chair, thank you for letting us present today. We all know that there's a shortage in home care. I can tell you that, you know, I have a hard time finding help at home. A lot of you have seen my mom come here to help me, and that's because I don't have help. Fortunately, today I have my nurse. But, you know, you've heard a lot of stories on this issue. Some of the best workers in home care are students in that transition role. You know, either they're undergraduates or they're, you know, recent graduates looking to enter a graduate program. And this really gives, you know, developing healthcare professionals a chance to get experience in home care and possibly be inspired to stay in the field. So I think, you know, it's a very good program. It's modeled after the federal program to, or inspired by, you know, to, you know, help areas of unmet workforce needs where there's, you know, student incentives to get in the field. And, you know, it's a simple idea with a small request. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there any other testifiers? Representative Claiborne?
Do you wish to testify?
Hello and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gabriel Roderick. I'm a person with a spinal cord injury. I'm here to testify today because I have experience working with college students who became my caregivers. And I have two stories to tell, the first being of my caregiver, Nikki, who I hired through reaching out to the kinesiology department at the U of M and looking for caregivers to help me get through my day. And she ended up being my caregiver for about 2 years, and she was always on time, was very willing and ready to do all the work that was presented to her. And then I had another caregiver who I don't remember the name, but we were training her in, and I won't go into the gory details of caring for me, but she was learning to catheterize and left the room because she got food poisoning. And this was a student who was in nursing school, and she ended up leaving that day, and I didn't end up hiring her because she wasn't fit for the job. And now, 6 years later, Nikki just finished nursing school, and I would hope that, that other caregiver that I trained in did not become a nurse, because she was not fit for the job. And I think this program that's being presented is it's giving people who are going into the fields of care, whether that be nursing, PT, OT, you know, working in assisted living homes, this gives them the opportunity to learn about the work and actually see if they're built for it. And, you know, the flip side of that is that we need caregivers. So I think this benefits both sides.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So members and audience, we have this room until 5 o'clock. We have at least 10 bills. Mm-hmm. So our goal is to get through all 10 bills. And so we're going to try to give each bill 15 minutes each. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Members, any questions? There be no further discussion. The chair renews a motion that House File 2182 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion prevails. The House File 2182 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you so
Madam
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, so our next bill will be 2231. Representative Cantrell, is he here? Okay. Okay, we're going to move on to 2027, Representative Zerwas. Is Cantrell here? Okay. Okay, yeah. Come on down, Representative Zerwas. Okay. So the chair moves House File 2027 for recommended for placement on a general register. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Zerwas, I understand you have an author's amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I have an A1 okay. amendment, if that can be moved.
The chair will entertain a motion of the A1 author's amendment.
So moved.
So moved. Representative Albright moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, present your bill, please.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 2027 deals with volunteer health care providers and allowing them access to a program currently operated by the state of Minnesota to provide insurance coverage for these volunteer health care programs. That program is currently geared towards providing care and services to the underinsured communities. I had a group contact me who's having trouble retaining volunteer physicians to do health screenings. the employers of these physicians had concerns about the extension of their liability insurance to their volunteer services. And under state law, the voluntary program couldn't access this program because this specific program does health screening, not health care. And the specific health screening that they do is cardiac screening to screen for previously undiagnosed congenital heart defects. And the target audience isn't the underinsured or uninsured community. It's a general school-age population of children that are in high school competitive sports. It's kind of their wheelhouse. And so the Play for Patrick volunteer group that does this is looking for an inclusion into this program in order to provide insurance protection to their physicians that are providing health screening at a voluntary, on a voluntary basis. And I think I do have one testifier in the audience, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Do we have George Singer? All right, come on up. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, who you with, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is George Singer, and I am a member of the Board of Directors for the Play for Patrick Heart Foundation. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm here, obviously, to ask you to support House File Number 2027. Gail and Mike Schoonover, who are the principal founders of the Heart Foundation, which, is, by the way, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Gail and Mike watched their son Patrick pass away during a hockey game in Brainerd in 2014. Patrick was 14 years old. The medical examiner determined that Patrick had two undetected heart defects, which caused sudden cardiac arrest, despite the fact that he had four doctor's visits during his last 2 years of life, two of which were sports physicals. In 2015, we established a Play for the Patrick Heart Foundation. The foundation provides heart screens at area high schools and community centers. The screens are all free to all kids ages 14 to 24. And we check the kids' family history, height and weight, blood pressure, and perform an EKG, echocardiogram, and listen to their heart. Our volunteer physicians meet with families to discuss the results and in many cases recommend follow-up care with a primary physician. We also teach kids and adults bystander CPR and AED awareness and donate AEDs to host high schools. From August 2015 to February 2019, the foundation has conducted 15 comprehensive heart screens and has screened over 2,700 children. The results of our efforts so far, we found 157 with elevated blood pressure with repeated checks, identified 218 kids with abnormal electrical or structural heart defects, and taught over 2,500 kids and adults CPR and AED awareness and donated six AEDs to area high schools. In order to provide the best experience and outcomes, we need cardiac physicians, medical doctors, and other medical professionals to help us at the screens. Many of these wonderful people want to help and donate their time and skills, but are not able. This is due to the fact that most hospitals and medical groups will not allow them to do so, or that the physicians are not covered by their own malpractice carrier while providing free medical assistance through any organization. Furthermore, our foundation is not able to purchase medical liability coverage for our volunteers and because they're not employees of the foundation. And we do not currently qualify for the state's volunteer health care provider program as it is currently written. Providing these screens is making a difference in identifying kids with heart defects. Supporting this bill will allow medical professionals we so desperately need to volunteer without risk. Without this bill, we have no choice but to stop providing these screens, which we think would be a shame and are providing a valuable free service to our youth. That's my testimony. I want to thank you for your time and support.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 2027? Members, any questions? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas. I'm co-author on the bill. I think it's a great idea. I remember when you came to ask me to sign on and everything. But I also am kind of wondering, I know this is the motion is to send this to the General Register, but I don't know too much about this this in basically insurance, as I'm understanding the bill, it's trying to have extend the medical professional liability insurance that the state has. And I wonder if there's been any exploration of whether that has a cost, because it would, one would assume if we put more providers doing more stuff into that coverage, that we might increase the cost of the coverage. I'm not exactly sure how that works. Do you know, Representative Zerwas?
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling, for the question. My understanding is in the other body, that was the trajectory of the bill, was to be heard in their combined Policy and Finance Committee, and then went to general orders. My understanding is that this is an insurance program operated through the Department of Commerce, and I haven't had any contact with anybody with questions or concerns about increasing program costs.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just reading the summary here, because the bill itself doesn't, it's just a section of law, and it doesn't have all of what this relates to, but it says that this is the administrative services unit for the health-related licensing boards that operates this. And I'm a little uncomfortable sending this to the floor without more assurance that it doesn't have any fiscal impact. The other thing I wonder, Madam Chair, is whether this, since it deals with insurance, whether it should maybe go to a Judiciary and Civil Law Committee, which, or no, that wouldn't be, even be the right one. I think it would be Commerce. Whether, and this has not been to Commerce, has it, Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. No, it didn't in the other body go to Commerce, and it nobody from Commerce has requested this bill as of yet. I can certainly talk to the Commerce Chair, but I have not heard from anybody requesting that Commerce take a look at this.
Chair Liebling.
Madam Chair, I wonder if I guess I've been given a note here that says that Mr. Berg looked at the bill and said that it didn't need a ways and means stop, so I assume that means it doesn't have a cost. So I think you've been cleared, Representative Zerwas. So, yeah, at least on that score. Thank you.
But I do understand your concern. That was a really good concern. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Zerwas, I'll try to be brief because I know we want to keep things moving, but I want to say a thank you, actually, to Representative Zerwas for bringing this forward, and Chair Liebling for sponsoring this as well. I can tell you that my mother is a nurse of 43 years, and in particular, she is a cardiac nurse in cardiac critical care at HCMC. And so there are a lot of folks who are actually running around undiagnosed, oddly enough. So I think there's incredible merit in this bill, and I would encourage folks to strongly support this bill. Thank you very much for bringing it forward.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, I understand the organization that brought this to you and their admirable goals and being a nonprofit. But I'm concerned that the language here is written really broadly, and it applies to anyone who offers free healthcare monitoring or screening services to the public, which is a very typical marketing technique for many alternative and even mainstream health resources when you're setting up a business. I don't think your intent was for every entity that's starting out as a chiropractor or an acupuncturist, a therapy of some sort or another that offers that free screening, be covered by this insurance. And I think you need to really look at narrowing this to a nonprofit organization whose goal is, and maybe it's related to the referrals, follow-up as well, that the primary purpose is not to generate business for the sponsoring organization or facility. I think that would just clarify your intent. I think nobody has a problem with the intent of offering, you know, screenings to catch things. We want to do that. But I just think you might have a broader net than you actually intended.
Representative Ross.
Well, thank you, Representative Loeffler, and I appreciate that. And if between now and the floor, if you have some suggestions, I'll work with you to accomplish that.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Madam Chair, I think it's it really – have you had a discussion yet, Representative Zerwas, with the holder of this insurance policy? Because I think they would actually be most skilled at helping you identify what they can and can't cover within the limitations of their current effort.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. Throughout the process, as this bill has moved forward and gone to general orders in the other body, and as it's moved forward and scheduled for a hearing here, I haven't had anybody from the insurance holder or provider reach out to me with any concerns.
Representative Freiberg.
Pass.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, the chair renews a motion that House File 2027, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The House File 2027, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you so much. Representative Zerwas.
He's back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't want to
House File 783. So the chair moves that House File 783 be recommended for placement on a general register. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Zerwas, I understand you have two author's amendments. The chair will entertain a motion on the A1-1 author's amendment. So move. Representative Albright moves the A1-1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I don't want to offer the next one.
You do not?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so that would be the A19-0276. Okay. Well, please introduce your bill, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 783 deals with licensing and regulation for body art technicians through the Department of Health. The amendment that we just offered was language requested by the Minnesota Department of Health. I have one testifier here today to talk to the changes that we're proposing to make in statute.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carol Tepley, and I am the president of Almost Famous Body Piercing. We have four Minnesota locations. They are located in Mall of America in Bloomington, Crossroads Mall in St. Cloud, a freestanding location in Northeast Minneapolis, and our newest location is in the River Hills Mall in Mankato. To give you a reference of what body piercing is regulated in Minnesota. Is a penetration or puncturing of the skin except on the outer perimeter or lobe of the ear for the purpose of inserting jewelry or other objects in or through the body. We are a regulated business in Minnesota, and although it would certainly be easier to operate without that regulation, I strongly believe that the regulations are necessary in order to protect the public. I've seen many do-it-yourself piercings and piercings done by friends and family members who have no experience at all with body piercing. After all, how hard can it be? As professionals, we must focus on safety for both the technician and the person wishing to get pierced. Better access lessens the chance of seeing some of the things I saw early in my career before regulation. In the early 1990s, I had a young teen come into my store looking for jewelry for her tongue. When I asked her what size she needed, she said she didn't know. I asked her to stick out her tongue. What I saw was a black sooty mark in the center of her tongue and what looked like a splinter. When I asked her more about her piercing, she said her mom and her mom's boyfriend had sterilized an ice pick with a lighter and had used it to pierce her tongue and put a toothpick in the hole to hold it open until she could get jewelry.
Wow.
I suggested she go to the emergency room and have the toothpick removed and cautioned her about infection. As much as I support regulation, we have found that recently enacted regulations concerning the supervisors of body piercing temporary technicians, those people who supervise technicians who are training to be fully licensed body piercers, have made it difficult to train and maintain qualified body piercers. Body piercing is an entry-level position, and like all entry-level positions, we have workforce challenges related to recruitment and turnover. Training a body piercer is about training someone to perform a procedure. It really is pretty straightforward, and it's very different than training someone to be a tattoo artist. Prior to the law change 2 years ago, there was no limit other than licensure on who could train a new body piercer. With that law change, it now requires 2 years of licensure before you can supervise. HF 783 would change that to 1 year and also allow the option of having performed 500 piercings as a licensed piercer. This change, I believe, better reflects the experience necessary to train and supervise new body piercers. Additionally, we are asking that you allow a body piercing supervisor to supervise up to 4 people without a supervisory plan. This reflects the difference in supervising a body piercing that can take minutes to perform and supervising a technician doing tattoo art that can take hours to perform. Body piercing for years was part of our subculture with no regulation. It's part of our mainstream culture now, and it does need to be regulated. But it needs to be regulated in a way that allows for legitimate businesses to survive so that we don't drive the practice of body piercing back underground. I believe HF 783 provides the right balance between needed regulation and protecting the public. I ask for your support of HF 783 and also would like to thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you. I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I'm still trying to get that visual out of my mind. Chair Liebling.
Be a good diet.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, look, he's already shaking his head. I have visuals in my mind from a previous hearing that Zerwas had.
It's all coming back.
Like a late night movie.
Oh, God, it's all coming back.
It is indeed. And Representative Zerwas, I guess my question is, it makes some sense as the testifier has presented it. Are those piercings included? You know what I'm talking about. There are some piercings. I'm not at this moment sure if they're legal in Minnesota or not. Maybe the testifier can enlighten me, but there are people get very intimate body parts pierced. And so this is we think of it, okay, the tongue, you know, we're used to some of these things, but some of this is really, it approaches surgery, honestly, in its, you know, in the invasiveness of some of this. And I want to know whether this bill applies to that, or are those procedures not legal in Minnesota, or just what, Representative Zerwas, if you would?
Representative Zerwas.
Madam Chair, I couldn't be more thankful for this. I'm going to allow my testifier to handle this one.
Mrs. Tipley.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, currently the requirements for transitioning from a temporary technician to a permanent technician requires a total of 500 piercings. 250 are under direct supervision, 250 are under indirect supervision, meaning that the supervisor needs to be on site for that temporary technician to pierce. The concern about the certain types of piercings that you raised, that is not the bulk of what we do. We do some, the really extreme piercings, we don't even have people inquire about. So as far as like training them to do some of those things, we tell all of our technicians, if somebody's asking you to do something that you've A, never done, or B, you're unsure of even what it is, you have the right and the responsibility to turn that down. and we don't have any kind of reservations about doing that.
You're leaving? Well, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I'm sure you don't, but the law is for everybody. And what I understood from what you just said is that the law would allow, after this amount of practice that you've just described, would allow those piercings to be done legally, even if the person had never seen them done, had never done one under supervision or otherwise. So I don't know. So reducing, now, granted, that may be true of the current law as well.
Yep.
And I think maybe the bill I remember was where Representative Zerwas might have been trying to reduce that or restrict that. Hmm. I wonder if we could do that again, Representative Zerwas. Then I'd be a lot more comfortable with this bill. But I'm very, you know, this is the ones we think of. Sure, I take the testifier's point. You know, you can see him do them a few times, and you probably are pretty safe. You understand the infection and the sterilization and all of that stuff. But this is like getting a general license. And some of these things, not everybody may be as ethical about not doing things that's out of their comfort zone. So I don't know, Representative Zerwas, do you have a help me feel more comfortable about this?
Madam Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Levin, no, I get your concern, I get your understanding. The bill that I had previously worked on that we handled in one of those late night hearings. Oh, God. that was the topic, was about body modification and tattoos that do almost borderline in some instances on medical procedures. That portion of that bill did not become law. It has not been back before this body since. This language, amending the supervision requirements, the amendment that we adopted to this bill is some Department of Health language. My understanding is the Department of Health is comfortable and supportive with this language. And so at this committee stop, it's probably the best that we can do, Madam Chair. If you'd like to work on this bill further, I guess we could look into that.
Okay, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I assume that we are referring to genital and nipple piercing, since we're unable to say that out loud. And I would just like to say that a tongue piercing is anatomically much more invasive than a genital piercing. And so that would make me much more uncomfortable. Just as the gynecologist in the group, I thought I should weigh in.
Yeah.
Where were you 2 years ago?
Chair Liebman. Right, and Madam Chair, and just for Representative Morrison, it's not that we can't say it, it's that we had this experience with this late night committee where things got kind of out of control. We're trying to kind of keep it in control here. So
it showed up in the Star Tribune.
Yeah. Mm. So I wonder if we could have someone from the Department of Health come down and comment.
Do we have someone here?
Okay.
Okay, thanks. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you with and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Melissa Finnegan. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Health. And like Representative Zerwas, I am having flashbacks to that hearing of 2 years ago. The A1 amendment, as Representative Zerwas mentioned, is Department of Health language, a policy bill that we requested he add very kindly to his bill on body art, just clarifying some of what the supervisory plans must include for this reason. We are comfortable with the underlying bill. And Representative Liebling, if you do want to have a conversation about restricting certain types of potentially dangerous body piercings, we are happy to have that conversation with you.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Finnegan. I appreciate that. And, you know, just to Representative Zerwas, you know, I'd love to work on it, but I don't have time. So, you know, I'm going to put, you're going to, I'm glad you're taking it on, but, you know, nevertheless, you know, we want to make sure that we're doing our due diligence for Minnesotans and making sure that, you know, there's a balance, of course, between individual right to do whatever you want with your own body, which I do support that, and making sure that when people go to pay money to get that done, that it's safe as reasonably possible to make it. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerba, since you've made this kind of a specialty of yours, I just thought I'd let you know that in my community, when you think about a temporary tattoo technician, what comes to mind is the henna artists who are do beautiful cultural designs that last for several weeks, not years or lifetimes. And I just think that in your next iteration of this bill, you might want to think about something other than temporary, rather than a trainee position or a level one position. I just haven't seen this in our licensing before. Refer to someone who's in training, who's starting out, is called temporary. So in your next bill, when you address all those interesting issues that Representative Liebling brought up, you can deal with that too.
Okay, Representative Zeroth.
Madam Chair, my understanding for temporary body art technicians, it refers to the piercings, because the piercings are temporary. They can be removed.
The temporary tattoo.
Ms. Timpley?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there's two different types of licenses that a technician needs to apply for in order to become a fully licensed body art practitioner in the state of Minnesota. The first one is a temporary technician license, under which they are supervised under a permanent technician. So that's the difference between the two. Temporary does not mean that the artwork is temporary, but that's a temporary licensure while they're working towards being a permanent license.
Madam Chair, I understood that. Although I say temporary tattoos have a different meaning in many different settings. But it's not a typical licensing term that we use for all the occupations that we license to call someone temporary. And so I'm just saying, as we update the statutes over time, you might think of something like trainee or level one or pre-license or something like that.
Representative Freiberg.
Pass.
Okay. Being no further discussion. The chair renews a motion that House File 783, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 783, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. This seems like this is a Representative Zerwas day. So up next, we have House File 1867. The chair moves that House File 1867 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee members. Representative Zerwas, I understand you have two authors' amendment. One?
I think it's one.
Okay, one. So the chair entertains a motion for the A1 author's amendment.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment.
Representative Albright moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to have an afternoon to spend in your committee. I really appreciate it. House File 1867 will sound somewhat familiar to members that have been here the last few years. It was brought to me by my county, Sherburne County, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association. The bill addresses county challenges relating to hospitalization criteria for county clients ready to be released from the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and community behavioral health hospitals. Counties have run into problems in getting their clients released from these facilities and placed in the community on a timely basis. Current statute requires counties to pick up 100% of the cost when the facility deems the person no longer meets medical criteria. The per diem for these facilities is quite high. AMRTC is $1,390 a day, and a day at a CBHH is $1,465 a day. This bill would establish a state agency hearing in which a county could dispute the cost of care for their clients in a state operative facility if a client's discharge is delayed due to a few specific reasons. A lack of notice that the client no longer qualifies for the facility services, a determination the client no longer meets the medical criteria is made on a holiday or weekend. The facility disagrees with the county's recommended discharge plan, or the paperwork from the facility is incomplete. The legislation also makes it clear the client is not to be billed under these circumstances. The author's amendment that we adopted removes the language to address concerns, some of the concerns that the department has raised. However, we do want conversation between the department and the counties to continue regarding this issue and the lack of available beds for individuals who meet criteria for safety net services. With me today is Deb Shearsom, Director of Human Services from Otterdale County, who will walk through the current process and some of the implications that it's had in their county.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, who you with, again, and proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Shearsom, and I serve Otterdale County in the capacity of Human Services Director. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of House File 1867. And on behalf of Otterdale County, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, MICA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, and the Association of Minnesota Counties, AMC. A version of this legislation passed in 2018, however, was part of the budget bill that ultimately was vetoed. At the request of our authors, counties met with DHS during the interim. In fact, we met monthly for about 5 months. Significant progress was made in terms of where we started, and the department indicated they would be able to operationalize many of our concerns. However, we have not been able to come to complete agreement about an appeals process, and legislation change is necessary in order to address the ability to have an appeal process for counties. This afternoon, I want to share with you some of the reasons why we support the language changes proposed in this bill. Between Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, AMRTC, and the Community Behavioral Health Hospital, CBHH, the statewide total cost to counties was just over $60.8 million 2016 to 2018. Counties pay whether or not they have the ability to move the person to another facility or an appropriate community arrangement, whether notice was received timely, or if there is a bed available. The intent of this proposal is to address situations where a person receives hospital service, receiving hospital services no longer meets hospital level of care criteria, but then the person is not immediately discharged due to a delay caused by the facility. As Representative Zerwas indicated, counties are responsible for 100% of the cost when the person doesn't meet medical criteria. At the current per diems, this adds up quickly. Otterdale County's costs are only a portion of the costs to all counties, but significant to our budget. As an example, in one case, we had a person whose service need became do not meet criteria, and he needed to move from a CBHH to a community addiction recovery enterprise care facility. The case manager at Otterdale County discussed options with the staff at the facility, requesting the person go to the care program that was located in Fergus Falls. As there was not an opening, they discussed the care facility at Wilmer and the care facility at Anoka. The CBHH staff placed the person on the Anoka care wait list without further exploring what would need to be in place for the person to go to the Wilmer facility, which had an immediate opening. This resulted in 13 days of do not meet criteria costs being incurred by Otterdale County when there was a bed available at the Wilmer facility, and the person was not well served by not being able to get to a treatment program in a timely fashion. In this case, Otterdale County contacted direct care and treatment leadership at the Department of Human Services at the time we received the notice, and then we worked with them to review what had occurred and agreed the cost incurred by the county was primarily the fault of the state. However, due to the statutory language, they were not able to allow or forgive or adjust any cost of the county, and so we would be billed and responsible for just over $19,000. Otter Tail County, with a population of just over 58,000 people, had a total cost in calendar years 2016 to 2018 of over $750,000 for people who were deemed to no longer meet criteria. An option to appeal these costs when the person is unable to discharge due to no fault of the county would be very helpful. It would benefit the counties. As a representative of MICA and MAXA, I can assure you that all counties would like to have the opportunity to appeal. We believe that this bill would create more transparency in decision-making and discharge planning for people served. We have been and remain very willing to partner with the Department of Human Services and the facilities to make this happen. To summarize, we've worked with the Department of Human Services to address concerns from last year's original legislation, which included the removal of requirements that would provide for a 10-day notice before the person is discharged, as well as eliminating the request for a comprehensive wait list. We agreed to remove these two provisions as the department indicated that they would be able to make these changes through internal procedure and policy without legislation, and we have continued to work with them on these issues. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today, and that concludes my testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. Mm-hmm. The next testifier will be Deputy Commissioner Chuck Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record, who you with, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. As Representative Ross said and Ms. Schustrom said, we have been working with the counties on this language. The amendment that Representative Ross put on today significantly mitigates one of the concerns that we had in the bill, and so we appreciate that. There's a couple of other issues that we want to work on, one within the amendment, the definition of safety net services is pulled from a report, and we're not sure that that's a great definition to be using for this purpose. And secondly, we have different ideas of how the appeals process might work. We've talked with the counties that we may or may not come to agreement on it. This actually, the process in the bill actually moved it through a formal appeals process with a human services judge. Often in other health systems, this is dealt with sort of within the health system when there's an appeal. As Ms. Schustrom said, the issue now is that even if we kind of go like, yeah, we didn't kind of screwed up here, the law says we still have to apply the money to the counties because there isn't any mechanism for us to undo that the way it's set up now. To be clear, these dollars do not come to DHS. They go to the general fund. So this isn't a thing where we have an incentive in one direction or another. These are dollars to the general fund.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on 1867? Members, any questions? Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Zerwas, for working on this. This is one of those really hard issues to resolve, and I appreciate your efforts. I'm a little concerned because we're really kind of running out of time for this session to resolve these things. And I know that this one, this has been a thorny one. I'm really sympathetic to the counties, but I also am really concerned about possible costs that we're not going to be able to afford. So I hope that I just wanted to speak to say to the sort of the parties here to really get at this and figure out something, because this is going to pass out of this committee today. It's going to come to the Finance Committee, I assume. We have almost no hearing time left, and we do not have time. We are really out of time to keep working on stuff. So I really appreciate that you've done it up to this point. And I just kind of want to give everybody that sort of signal that we're just going to run out of time, and then nothing will happen this year. So thank you.
All right, Representative Ron.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Chair Liebling. I completely understand. It's one of those things that we worked on this whole session last year. I don't know if you recall, but the fiscal note for this bill came forward finally from the department last year, I think 2 days before final markup of the HHS supplemental budget bill hearing. And so if I've experienced one thing over the last couple of years working on this issue, it's the ability for the clock to be leveraged against the counties. And I don't put a motive to that. I just say that's reality. Literally since the, as the testifier mentioned, since the end of session last year when the supplemental budget bill was vetoed, the counties and the department have been meeting monthly all the way through. My understanding is there was what the counties believed to be broad agreement pretty close up until we got really next to session. And then there was more concerns, and there was more concerns. And what we're seeing to each of the counties you represent is this is a real impact fiscally for counties in greater Minnesota. It only needs to take one or two discharge challenges, and you've eaten up a half an FTE in a human services budget in a county in greater Minnesota. And so this has a significant impact on our counties to be able to deliver care and deliver services. The challenge is what the way current law is written is that even in instances when the determination of does not meet medical necessity, we've seen examples from counties where that determination in the past has been made on a Friday night at 9 p.m., been faxed over to a county office where there's nobody there on a holiday weekend when no one comes back till Tuesday. And then the state says, give us our money. And it puts the counties in an impossible position to be able to come out okay. And every time that happens, what we're doing is we're taking the ability of that county to hire a social worker, put someone in place to address the opioid epidemic, put someone in place to investigate issues of child welfare. And so this has a huge direct impact on the counties. It's been going on for several years. There was broad agreement last year until there wasn't, until the county, until the department pulled out. And so I will encourage, along with you, Madam Chair, that both groups do come together and hammer something out in an expeditious fashion. But what I would implore to the committee and to the body is that this is, if at all possible, this isn't something that we should wait on for another year.
Chair Leiby. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Zerwas, the instances you gave, I'm very well aware of them, which is why I said that I'm very sympathetic to the counties. I mean, I think we've all heard about these kind of things, and I agree with you. We have to do something about this. But I just want to say, let's not let the best be the enemy of the good, because I think counties, if we can get to something that may not be 100% of what the counties need, but we can get them in a better position, we will have helped, because it really is a pretty difficult problem for some, especially smaller counties. So, you know, acknowledging what you said, you know, let's make sure that we do something and not, you know, and not say we won't take anything if we don't get it all. So, thank you.
Thank you for that, Chair Leiby. Yes, good. So, there. Okay, there have been no further discussion. The chair renews a motion that House File 1867, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevailed, and House File 1867, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Cantrell. We're going to go back to House File 2231. The chair moves that House File 2231 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Cantrell, I understand you have an author's amendment. So I'd like to entertain a motion for the A1 author's amendment. Anyone? Okay. Representative Pinto moves the A1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cantrell, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you again. Today I'm bringing before you House File 2231. It is based on a substance use disorder rate study that DHS published recently, and it should be included in your packets. And this study made a number of findings. I won't go over all of which, but essentially we seek to improve the quality of comprehensive substance use disorder provider reimbursement by making the following changes in this bill. It's going to require DHS to develop a comprehensive rate methodology for substance use disorder treatment services based on a continuum of care, based on the full complexity of the task of helping individuals overcome substance use disorder. It requires DHS to develop legislation to achieve this goal, and it requires DHS to report back to the legislature in November of 2020 any necessary licensing standards that need to be changed in order to implement the new comprehensive rate methodology. Additionally, and this is what's covered in Section 2 of the bill, I should start by saying in Section 1 there is going to be a percentage rate increase, but we'll address that when and if this bill makes it to DHS finance. In Section 2 of this bill, that's where we have the language where DHS needs to develop a comprehensive rate methodology that reimburses substance use disorder treatment providers in a manner that accurately reflects the full spectrum of these provider expenses, which have continued to grow over the past handful of years. And it also requires DHS to provide stakeholder facilitation and outreach to substance use disorder providers when developing this new rate methodology, and ensures that the outreach that or the parties involved that DHS will be reaching out to cover the spectrum of care, whether that is residential treatment services, outpatient treatment, whether that treatment takes place in greater Minnesota or takes place in the metro. And we're going to make sure that everybody kind of has a seat at the table here so that we really develop a sustainable rate methodology that will ensure that that our substance use disorder practitioners are able to provide the full spectrum of services and in a way that is economically solvent and beneficial to the health of patients in Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you with and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tim Walsh, and I am a vice president with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. And I'm the co-chair of the Government Affairs Committee of March. The other testifier, Dean Gilbertson, who is our president, wanted to be here, but he encountered a conflict. So thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. The March Association is the largest statewide professional association for addiction care providers and professionals in the state of Minnesota, with a total of 2,494 members. Our providers do cover the spectrum of care from inpatient, outpatient, hospital, and board and lodging facilities. And I'm here to support House File 2231. As Representative Cantrell mentioned, House File 2231 does two important things. First of all, it gives providers a critical rate increase while the licensing standards continue to go up for providers and professionals. The cost of delivering care has also gone up, but the rates have not commensurately increased. Second, the bill requires DHS to develop a new rate methodology with the input of providers to work towards building out an ongoing sustainable rate structure that incents evidence-based practices and best practices for treatment models, which includes patient-centered care. With recent changes to Minnesota law, we are now moving away from acute or episodic models of care, and we are moving towards a value-based system that manages health. We at MARCH have worked with DHS countless hours over the past several years towards reforming the system so that it is based on patient-centered care and it provides a continuum or a spectrum of care. This value-based system of care and managing health includes the development of a personalized care plan. The goal of the plan is to achieve uninterrupted recovery based upon addressing all life areas, a holistic approach over the period of recovery, and it embraces this holistic approach to recovery and allows for patients to reassimilate back into their community as productive members of society. This new continuum of care is good for our patients, and with a major overhaul, it could be beneficial for providers and payers such as the state of Minnesota. These reforms are good for patients and will lead to better outcomes, but they don't come without a cost to providers. MARCH members look forward to participating in further reform of the system to build out these resources for people in treatment, but we face a major funding gap. In fact, DHS has just completed a report on for substance use providers, and the findings bear this out. This report says, I quote, state regulations have increased the training and qualifications required of SUD professionals, but the fees have not been increased commensurately, and that the state should, quote, establish modeled fee payment methodologies to reflect provider expenses for required elements of SUD outpatient and residential services. It goes on to talk about cost, that this being based, the cost of care being based upon a cost basis of methodology, and that continue to work out a whole spectrum of care, and the House File 2231 seeks to set up a process for DHS to do that with stakeholder input. Section 3 of the bill consists of a rate increase for substance use disorder providers, and we understand that this is in the jurisdiction of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We're requesting $10 million. That's $5 million a year over a two-year biennium. As we develop this spectrum of care and this continuum of care with stakeholders over in the new system. So we know that treatment works, but only 1 in 10 individuals who need treatment seek it. One major factor that contributes to people not getting treatment is that there's a shortage of access, especially in greater Minnesota. Absent some funding reform, our fear is that costs will continue to outpace reimbursement, and access to treatment will be severely impacted. Additionally, substance use disorder treatment is a good investment for the state. The National Institute of Health has a number of studies on this issue and estimate that there's anywhere from a 7-to-1 to a 12-to-1 return on investment for treatment. In other words, for every dollar the state spends on treatment, there's a 7-to-12-to-1 return in avoided costs in health care, criminal justice, and other societal costs. We would urge you to support this bill so that we can retain and grow access to substance use disorder treatment services throughout the state. And we'd urge the committee to pass House File 2231 as we continue to work towards a sustainable funding model that keeps access available to those who need treatment. Again, I'd like to thank Representative Cantrell, the committee, and the chair for this opportunity to share my testimony today.
Thank you so much. Dean Giberson is the next testifier.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
He was not able to make it. He had a conflict.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on 2231? Okay. Any discussion from members? Okay. So there being no further discussion, the chair renews a motion that House File 2231, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 2231, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Okay. We have Representative Pinto, House File 2217. Okay, Representative Pinto, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 2217 be recommended for referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right, we have the bill before the committee. Representative Pinto, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Madam Chair and members, in 2015, the legislature appropriated some new funding to counties to support the reduction of caseloads for child protection staff, and the formula imposed at the time created a withhold of 20% of that funding that counties can earn by meeting a couple of performance measures, one related to monthly visits, another with timely contact with children who've been screened in for a child protection assessment. And, of course, the intent of that was to improve caseloads, but the result has been a real challenge for counties in reliably budgeting and hiring staff to address caseloads. There's no fiscal impact from the bill. It's merely a policy bill. It's just changing the formula under which funds are distributed. This proposal does still include strong performance measures, but at the same time provide counties with full funding so they can conduct their work from a more consistent budgeting framework rather than having this 20% that puts them in a pretty precarious position. So I do have a testifier who can give you more information, Madam Chair members, about the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and who you will, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Moran and committee members. My name is Jody Hirung Dick, and I'm a social service manager with Sherburne County Health and Human Services. Testifying today on behalf of MACSA, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators. Thank you for hearing House File 2217 today that removes the withholds to counties for child protection staffing and services. To give you a sense of what counties have faced since 2015, when, as you know, many changes were made to screening processes related to child protection, I'd like to share some information from the DHS 2017 Child Maltreatment Report. Of those, in 2017, child protection agencies received a total of 84,148 reports of child maltreatment, which is a 4.8 increase from 2016. Of those reports, 44.8% were screened in. For those reports that were screened out, more than 9 out of 10 were screened out because the allegations did not meet the statutory threshold for maltreatment. Since 2008, there has been a 75% increase in completed investigations and assessments, which has greatly increased any funding increases. Staffing is one key component to making necessary improvements in this area. Counties are asking the legislation to eliminate the 20% withhold to counties so that we are better able to plan for staffing and service costs in our operating budget and focus on efforts to improve child safety. Counties absolutely agree that our child protection system needs to have high performance standards, and we respect the state's resources when it comes to improving the lives of children and families. How the withhold has played out has been less than desirable. If a county is struggling to meet its performance measures, 20% of their funding may be withheld. That 20%, along with any other county's 20%, is put into a pool that is then redistributed to counties who have met the outcome measures. What has happened, though, is that the withholding of resources, that we're withholding resources from counties that really need it the most. The unpredictability of funding can cause a county to not hire an additional child protection worker that could significantly decrease their caseload sizes. Or it's also, there's some counties that have been in the unfortunate circumstance of having to let a child protection worker go because they have not met that threshold. This also withholds resources and prevents counties from focusing on continuous quality improvement practices because there's no guarantee that money will be there in the next operating budget. If the withholds are eliminated, counties will still maintain high performance standards as we do across most of our services. Section 2 of the bill requests that DHS set child protection standards and that underperforming counties go through a program improvement plan. There is also a provision that would permit DHS to consider redirecting a county's funds specifically towards that program improvement plan. The bill would also permit sanctions under existing statute related to noncompliance. On behalf of counties, we ask for your support. Thank you for your time.
So I have a couple of questions for you in regards to what would you consider an improved child protection performance plan?
In relation to the two measures that this withhold is looking at, it would be improving face-to-face contact with children every month and ensuring that we're out there having face-to-face contact and ensuring child safety. And the other one is making sure that we would be out there within the timelines of child maltreatment to initiate an investigation. So those would be the two areas where a program improvement plan may be warranted if we're not meeting those standards.
And so the 20% withhold that you currently are withholding would help you do this by hiring more staff?
Yes. I mean, the Child Protection Grant does allow funding for counties to be able to hire additional staff, but that grant every year, there's that 20% withhold piece that we're not guaranteed. So we do get 80% of the funding, but with the 20% withhold, it makes it the budgeting process very unpredictable for the future years.
Okay. What are the, in your experience or expertise, what is the counties that need the services most?
Could you repeat that, Madam Chair?
What are, you stated that some of the counties who need the dollars or the services most are not being able to provide the services. What counties would those be?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I do not have them by name, but I can tell you in preparation for this testimony, I did ask about in 2018, how many counties were withheld. So I do know that 11 counties did not meet one of the measures for caseworker visits, and 18 counties did not meet the threshold for the face-to-face contact. So those would be the counties that we're looking at if this withhold would be undone, the 20% withhold, that they would receive additional funding to hopefully help them meet those measures.
This is Ms. Dick. Is there a way you can share the information with me about the 11 counties who were not able to follow through on the case and the 18 that didn't do the, I think you said, the visits? Can you share that information with me?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can find that information out.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
That would be great. All right, thank you so much for your testimony. Okay, the next testifier would be Patty Olson. And Sandy Daniels. Are you two together? Sandy Daniels Milton. Okay, please introduce yourself for the committee, for the record, and state your name and who you are, and please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Patty Olson Fell. I'm a social worker at St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services up in northern Minnesota. thank you for your time and letting us speak today. We just wanted to give some personal experience as we are both family educators. We work with many families who are involved in child protection services. We're social workers that go into the home and provide parenting education to try to keep families together who are involved in child protection services. I've been doing this for 14 years, and previous to that, for 5 years, I was a child protection assessment worker. And I know that child protection assessment workers do their very best to complete assessments in a timely manner and to see children in a timely manner. But there are times when staff is overwhelmed with incoming CPS referrals, which can make it very challenging sometimes to meet the timelines. You know, we see our colleagues struggle sometimes. For example, you may plan on going out to see a child on a new child protection referral, but you might get a call from a family who you're already providing services to. And, for example, last week we had a teenager who was suicidal. And the social worker spent 2 days trying to find a safe placement for that child because she could no longer be in her home. So we kind of see, you know, the day-to-day reasons, although I think our social workers in St. Louis County do a very good job of trying to get out in a timely fashion to see children with child protection matters. But another issue is, with the current, you know, opioid crisis, with the poverty, we work in rural communities, with the challenges we see with families in the northern Minnesota rural communities, it greatly increases the number of incoming child protection referrals. And so if funding is uncertain, it can mean that there will be less funding to do the work that we do to keep children safe. and so I just hope that, you know, you'll support this bill, because I think it's just very important. We're, my colleagues and myself are doing our very best to try to keep children in their families, to reduce the incidences of neglect and child abuse, and to keep children safe. And my colleague, Sandy Daniels-Milton, used to be an ongoing child protection worker, and I'll just let her tell you a little bit about her experience. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Please welcome to the committee and introduce yourself and who you are, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sandy Daniels-Milton. About 3.5 years ago, I was hired on child protection, 50 years old. Thought, hey, I can handle this. Not the easiest job, but quickly found out that my caseloads were double what was, you know, kind of proposed, and very difficult to maintain all the deadlines and be able to keep kids safe. So within 2 years, I was, or less, I was looking for something else within the county. Not that I wasn't capable, and not that I didn't think it was an important job, but, you know, the demands put on us were pretty tough, and I was like, I can do, I can handle a lot of things, and this is way over my head. So, and so then I quickly went into a different, thank goodness, position within that's more preventative, but I do want to advocate for the people that are still doing that tough job, a lot younger than me with a lot less experience.
Well, I just want to thank you both for your work and your service. We do know that St. Louis County has been inundated with a lot of cases that have been screened in. And so, and we know it's been tough trying to, you know, deal with the huge workload, secondary trauma yourself. And so, but thank you for that. Is there anyone else here in the audience who wishes to testify
thank you.
On?
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on 2217? Members, any questions? All right. So there being no further discussion, Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 2217 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 2217 is recommended for re-referral to the Committees on Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Pinto. We're going to move on to House File 559.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Madam Chair, I move that House File 559 be recommended for placement on the General Register, and I do have an author's amendment when we get to that.
Okay. So Representative Pinto moves the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Pinto, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hold on one moment.
Yes.
Madam
welcome
Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Tice. Thank you.
I'm joined by the past author of this proposal, Representative Tice. The bill requires that there be a provider-patient relationship for the purpose of having an ophthalmic examination. I may not be saying that word quite right, but I hope that I am. And then outlines requirements for the examination and make sure that there is that relationship. And I think that Representative Tice has some comments that she would like to make in support of the bill as well, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, especially Representative Pinto, for allowing me to put my 2 cents worth in today. The purpose of House File 559 is to better protect the doctor-patient relationship and health, eye health of consumers who are accessing online vision testing websites and apps in order to obtain prescriptions for contacts and glasses. I want to thank all of the primary stakeholders for finding consensus on this bill. I know that it's taken more than several years to get to an agreement.
Okay. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll turn things over to our testifier.
Okay. Is that Dr. Tommy Elton? Okay, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Reintroduce yourself for the tape and who you with and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dr. Thomas Elton. I'm an optometrist in Edina at Elton Eye Care.
And I'm a board member of the Minnesota Optometric Association, so I'm here representing all of Minnesota optometrists. This bill is important because it protects our patients in Minnesota. We believe that in order to receive a prescription for glasses or contact lenses, that you should have an in-person eye exam. This bill protects the doctor-patient relationship. So currently in Minnesota, you can go online or use an app just to take a selfie of your eyes or answer a few brief questions and receive a prescription for glasses and contact lenses, but there is no healthcare provider involved in the process. And there's lots of different apps out there, but none of them address any sort of eye health or systemic health at all. As you may know, optometrists and ophthalmologists both diagnose ocular disease like glaucoma and macular degeneration, but we also look at systemic disease like hypertension and diabetes, often first diagnosed at an eye exam. So the effect of these apps and online sites is to increase the cost of healthcare in Minnesota due to delayed diagnosis and delayed treatment. So we've reached an agreement with ophthalmology on the language of this bill, and I really want to thank Representative Pinto and Tice for their help. It's been a couple of years in the making, so thanks for your support.
You're welcome. We have another testifier, Eric Escalado. We'll let you introduce yourself.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the House and Human Services Committee. My name is Eric Costanita. I am the Government Affairs Manager for 1-800-CONTACTS. I thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify today. House File 559 recognizes the value of online vision services. Their ability to lower healthcare costs, increase care, is a phenomenal opportunity for all Minnesotan citizens. This compromise between optometric providers, eye care physicians, and online vision tests and vision testing services has really been a compromise that is really beneficial to the average citizen. If adopted, this legislation would provide necessary oversight of vision testing services while promoting their use. For us, as a provider of online vision testing services, we know that the primary concern is healthcare. House File 559 does is provide different eye care providers that opportunity to look at a patient's medical history, also review clinical data that is then stored and forwarded to providers to make that necessary judgment call in providing a prescription and prescription services. With that, thank you so much for this opportunity, and I guess I can answer any questions if so needed.
But thank you for your testimony. For me, as one who's worn glasses probably almost all my life, you know, I do recognize and value the importance of going to see an optometrist, but, you know, often it's not covered by health insurance. And right. So what do we do for those individuals who go online to get a prescription because they, you know, it's cheaper? How do we support that?
With Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question and one that we see quite often. Mm-hmm. With these vision online services, we are actually able to provide consumers with a lower cost, but still maintain that doctor-patient relationship where a licensed ophthalmologist in the state of Minnesota is able to review the clinical data and provide them with a prescription that would fit them for either glasses or contact lenses.
Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The previous testifier made a reference to a requirement that the examination occur in person, but I do want to make sure to note in lines 2.7 to 2.21 that there are a couple of other possibilities, that it can be through face-to-face interactive two-way real-time communication, can be through store and forward, so there are some other options. I should note that I have an eye condition since birth that limits almost all my sight in my right eye, and I spent a lot of time mostly with ophthalmologists in my case. But it is, I think, important that that there be the level of protection that's laid out in the bill to make sure that when there is that examination, that it is sort of done upright, but that does not have to be in person, which I think should help with some of the cost and other alternatives as well, I would think.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, or anyone else who wants to answer, how do you do an examination through the screen?
Who would like to?
I could speak, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I can actually speak to that.
Okay.
How we do that through our app-based services is we actually provide the patient with an online health questionnaire where they can answer questions if they've had glaucoma, diabetes. For our particular service, that would exclude a person from receiving any further treatment. Based on the app, there are other pieces of information that are required, pictures of the eye, where they do a Snell test, where you kind of see those small writings where it's E, M, F, those kind of small little symbols that are read from a distance based on the app itself. That information is then stored and forwarded to a licensed ophthalmologist who reviews the clinical data based on the health questionnaire, recordings and pictures of the eye itself, and then it's left to the doctor to use their medical judgment to make an assessment on their prescription.
Okay. Thank you. Would you also like to respond to the question?
Sure, Madam Chair. The answer is it's very difficult.
And we have Dr. Elton.
Yes, okay. Thank you. Yes. Very difficult. So that's why we're trying to regulate this a bit and have a provider in involved in the process. So pictures of the eyes are great, but not really don't compare it to a comprehensive eye exam. And this is great for people who don't have access maybe to go in to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist, but we want to make sure that there are safeguards for patients so they're not getting a false sense of security that their eyes are okay just by answering questions online or read an EVO. So we want to make sure that we're protecting patients with this bill.
Representative Mayer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I mean, you're doing a history, essentially, but we're not really doing a physical exam.
Not a physical exam, no. Recordings and photos that are forwarded to an ophthalmologist or an optometrist.
So, for Mr. Costanilla.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're with 1-800-CONTACTS?
Uh-huh.
And this is the same thing that's done for contacts, too,
yes.
Online.
So our services provides for contact lenses, yes.
Okay. What type of return do you have because it's not compatible with their vision?
To speak fairly to that, we usually see about a 30% dropout rate from those who essentially start the online vision testing. Mm-hmm. At that point, we actually refer the patient back for a comprehensive eye exam. So that could be a variety of different things where our ophthalmologists review the clinical data that has been sent to them, and they're making a judgment call saying, I won't be able to service or to help this particular patient, so we will refer them to an optometrist or an ophthalmologist within their area.
All right, thank you. Members, any other questions? Okay, there have been no further discussion. Representative Pinto renews his motion that House File 559, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 559, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Loeffler, House File 616.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 616 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, and I have a couple of author's amendments.
Okay. Representative Loeffler moves the A1 author's amendment.
Yes.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. You also have the A2 author's amendment.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All in favor of moving the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Loeffler, please.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. You know, we're continuing to strengthen and diversify and make our mental health system much more effective with faster outcomes for people, which I think is always our, and better outcomes for people. And this is another step along that way. And this is to increase access to community-based mental health services and to help people move out of more intensive and more expensive treatment options such as hospital level of care or care at our state institutions like Anoka Regional Mental Health Treatment Center. And what this bill does is it builds on the success of a bill I had carried on behalf of NAMI a few years ago, the first psychosis episode bill that was based on research that showed if you could get someone into treatment after that first psychosis event, they'd have much more success in treatment and in moving ahead with their lives than the typical process at the time, which was to let them continue to fail or try other less intensive sort of approaches before they got to really serious assistance. And this would expand it to first mood disorders for people with severe depression or bipolar, those sorts of circumstances, and surrounding them with the kind of intensive early intervention services that we would think will also help them with getting the right outcome. It also directs the Department of Human Services to develop recommendations on ACT teams, using new knowledge about how to make these teams work more effectively with youth. Our assertive community treatment teams, that's what ACT stands for, are community-based services that help people avoid hospitalization in patient or residential care. It also makes changes to our elderly waiver program because we have people who have gone to hospitalization settings such as our state-operated services, but we can't get out into the kind of supports that they need to continue their treatment under the elderly waiver program because of the limitations in that program, and this would make exceptions for them. It expands our current transition to treatment or to community program for people who are leaving Anoka Regional Treatment Center or other state-operated facilities, as well as to divert people from even having to go there with appropriate supports, and then provides appropriate funding to get all of this up and off the ground. So it's a menu of movement forward, and with that, I'll let Sue Abderholden give a little more detail.
All right. Thank you so much. Mrs. Abderholden, please introduce yourself for the record and who you with. We know you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. You know, every day at NAMI I receive an email or a call from a parent who's seeking help for their loved one who is struggling with a mental illness. It's often a young person under the age of 30, and I learn of their history. The hopes and dreams that they had for their son or daughter, and how frustrated they are that those dreams are dashed because they can't access the treatment needed. I learn of every crack in the system, every hole in the safety net. You've heard me say before that our mental health system isn't broken, it was never built. And what frustrates NAMI the most is that we know what to do. We know what works, which is, frankly, earlier identification and appropriate intervention. But all too often what happens is that the individual lives with their symptoms for months, sometimes years, before seeking help. And then the help that is provided is limited. We wait until I would say that people hit stage four before providing the intense help that's needed. So you're going to hear about a program today, two of them. The first is the First Psychotic Episode Program, which is, according to Results First, actually proven to be effective. So very, it got the gold star in that report. And what we've shown is that it prevents it from becoming a disabling condition. We don't yet know how to prevent schizophrenia from developing, but with this kind of program, we can prevent it from becoming disabling, and we can allow those hopes and dreams to become a reality. And we'd also like to expand this to mood disorders as well. ACT teams are also proven to be very effective, but we don't have enough, and we only go down to age 16. We need to think about this broader to have intensive services for children in the home. And then, as Representative Loeffler mentioned, the transition to community program and the elderly waiver, we need to make changes to those so people are not stuck in the, especially at Anoka and in our community hospitals. We hear about the log jams in our system, boarding in the ER, waiting for months in a community hospital for a public or private residential placement, people waiting to leave Anoka, but there aren't community services. We definitely have a flow issue, and we need to address it so our scarce resources are used appropriately and effectively. People with mental illnesses can recover and live fulfilling lives in the community, but only if the services and supports are there. So on behalf of NAMI Minnesota and the countless families who are frantically seeking help, please support this bill.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thank you so much for your work. You know, especially when you look at youth, like anything else, the sooner we can get a diagnosis, support, IU earlier, even the better the outcomes would be. So thank you. Catherine Cullen? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Catherine Cullen. I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist and an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, but I'm also the division director of child psychiatry at the U. Mood disorders, which include depression and bipolar disorder and psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia, are common medical conditions which often begin in adolescence and adulthood. These illnesses greatly interfere with a young person's ability to complete high school, go to college, be employed, and have successful adult relationships. As has been said already, the key to having a positive impact on these outcomes with treatment is early and effective treatment. Research has shown that the treatment for mood and psychotic disorders works best if it's started early and provided by a multidisciplinary team who can simultaneously address the needs of the whole patient and the family. In 2016, the Minnesota state funding allowed the creation of new programs such as Strengths and Navigate, which are both programs at the U for early stage psychosis. These are providing critical comprehensive services, including psychiatric care, but also psychological treatment, parent and family support, and counseling for people who are ready to return to school and work. And these wraparound programs have been incredibly effective in aiding recovery and improving quality of life for patients and their families. However, based on the large number of people who develop psychotic disorders each year, additional programs are needed. Further, we have no such programs for mood disorders at this time. In May 2018 at the University of Minnesota, Dr. David Bond and I created a new program to provide state-of-the-art assessment and medication management for youth, which is children, adolescents, and young adults with mood disorders. However, we're still small. We do not have these wraparound services that are included in these first episode programs like Strengths and Navigate. So to make a significant impact on the lives of youth with mood disorders in Minnesota, we urgently need funding to expand the new program. In summary, I urge you to support this bill to increase funding for early stage psychosis treatment and to initiate funding for early stage mood disorders treatment. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 616? Members, any questions? Representative Addison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So with the assertive community treatment teams, how many do we have in Minnesota right now? Do we have an estimate? Sorry.
Abda Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know off the top of my head. Many more than first episode programs. We only have four first episode programs.
Okay. So in terms of the appropriations for the first mood episode for the mood disorder and as well as the psychotic disorder. So I'm wondering, are clinics going to be applying for these grants then? Is that how it's going to work?
Madam Chair, Representative, the way that the first episode and hopefully in the future the mood programs work is that the Department of Human Services puts out an RFP and asks for clinics to apply. So right now we have actually two at the University of Minnesota, one at HCMC and one at HDC in Duluth. Based on our population using the New York model, we think that we need at least eight in Minnesota, but we also have to think of something a little different than, for example, in New York. If you think about the geographic area, you would need, for example, in northwestern Minnesota to have enough population to have a first episode program. It would be long distances, and so we needed to actually create what I would call Ronald McDonald homes for people with psychosis so that they have a place to stay and their family does as well, and that's why the language was included in there. And I do know the Department of Human Services is up there, and they know how many ACT teams, but I can't read their hand signals to be able to to be able to tell you.
Is there anyone else who can respond to the question here from the department?
And then actually, Madam Chair, if I could just one other question while they're going to be coming down. In that RFP, do we have any idea in terms of the population that we're going to be able to be serving, how many people This is specific to kids, correct?
Mrs. Abdaholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, typically, you know, it's about 1% of the population. And one of the things that those programs have to do is actually do outreach into the community. So, you know, colleges, community colleges, pediatricians, family practice, kind of everyone, high schools, so that people know what those early signs are and aren't afraid to actually refer people to them so that we get them early. Right now, it's an average of 74 weeks between the onset of symptoms and getting help, which is way too long. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Edelson?
Okay. No, and you were just going to speak to the ACT teams, how many we have currently.
Yes, please introduce yourself for the record and who you're with and proceed.
For the record, my name is Haley Kolkine with the Department of Human Services. Currently, we have 16 ACT teams within Minnesota.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, member? All right. There have been no further discussion. Representative Loeffler renews her motion. The House File 616, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 616, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Okay, Representative Loeffler, we're going to move into House File 1983. Can you please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 1983 be recommended for placement on the General Register.
All right. You have the bill. Members, we have the bill before us. Representative Loeffler.
House Bill 1983 creates a definition in law for intervener, who are professionals who work with children who are both deaf and blind. And I first encountered this concept with a constituent who told me of her early life with her son, born without sight or the ability to hear, and how intimidating it was to try and develop that and grow a relationship with a young infant with their only ability to communicate to be by touch, and how she felt like their family's life was transformed and her young son was able to make so much more progress once they had an intervener visiting them to help them understand how to build that communication system so that they could unlock his potential as well as their ability to interact together more effectively as a family. And DHS has had grants for interveners since the 1990s. We never have enough. But the work of these providers has evolved since that time, and national standards and certification are evolving. And we think it's important for us to define the service in statute as we move forward. And that's what this legislation would do. And I have a couple of witnesses. With me, I have Sally Prudy and her son, Andrew, to tell you a little more about what that life experience is like.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. I'm behind Jeremiah.
Good afternoon, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about adding the definition of interveners to services for persons who are deaf-blind with HF 1983. And thank you, Representative Loeffler, for bringing this forward. My name is Sally Prouty, and I'm speaking on behalf of the approximately 400 kids in Minnesota who are deafblind. I'm the parent of Andrew here, who is proof of the miracle of interveners. When he was born, doctors told us he was deafblind and that his prospects weren't good. We did everything possible to figure out how we could make his life less isolating. So we were on a mission to learn everything that we could, and we discovered a program in Canada where they used interveners for kids who were deafblind. And if you think of Helen Keller and her teacher, Annie Sullivan, Annie was her intervener. So in the early 90s, I sat before this very same committee requesting intervener services for kids who were deafblind, and happily it passed. Adding a definition of interveners would help clarify the role and expectations of parents of children who are deafblind. It would also help, as we're heading down the road, to make it a more recognized profession. There are already recognized core competencies for training. There's a National Intervener Association, and there's credentialing and certification available. I've also been working with the National Coalition on Deaf Blindness and the National Intervener Initiative on federal legislation since 2013. that includes interveners for children who are deafblind. It's called the Cogswell-Macy Act. It's been in three sessions of Congress. But members of the Senate Health, Education, and Labor and Pensions Committee have pushed back, asking, what are the states doing? Saying that the states are the laboratories of invention. So Minnesota is leading the country in our services to kids who are deafblind, and adding a definition to Minnesota law would help strengthen and support that national bill. So I hope you will support HF 1983, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1983?
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Andrew Prudy. I'm deafblind. And sorry, let me check my papers. I'm deafblind and I've been working full-time, living independently, for about 18 years. And I graduated from Metro State University with a bachelor's degree. And I'm asking for you to please support this bill and adding a definition for interveners, because this will really help people to understand the definition and understand the role of interveners and provide more access for deafblind children nationwide. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there a discussion from the committee? There being no further discussion, Representative Laffer renews her motion that House Bill 1983 will be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. House File 1983 is recommended for placement on the general register.
Representative Bonner, you're up. House File 2069.
Thank you for taking
Representative Bonner, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move that House File 2069 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations.
Okay. We have the bill before the committee. Representative Bonner, please present your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I want to thank you today for allowing me the opportunity to introduce 2069 on the creation of a task force for community competency. In the last several years, there have been a marked increase in the number of individuals that have been identified across the state as incompetent to stand trial. Unfortunately, Minnesota is not alone in this trend, with other states experiencing similar concerns. What we do know is that several key factors have compounded the problem. These include legislation such as the 48-hour rule that removes these individuals from custody in county jails and sends them to state-owned treatment centers, and a bulletin issued by the Department of Human Services in December discharging patients due to lack of beds within these treatment centers. Add to these complexities an inadequate process to accommodate individuals that were deemed eligible to leave these state-owned facilities, that are either released back into the community in fragile mental health where there are no community-based competency resources, or they find their way back to the county corrections facilities where they once again are deemed unfit to stand trial and are placed in a situation where their condition can easily deteriorate further. Well, we know that there are marked differences across counties. The number of individuals identified as incompetent to stand trial range from counties with little or no individuals deemed unfit to counties with far more disproportionate numbers meeting the criteria. We suspect that some of these differences may be explained by yellow line programs that seek to provide early intervention before booking or incarceration and steer individuals to proper early intervention and treatment rather than entering the system. But the simple truth is, we simply don't know. Based on the sharp rise in the numbers of individuals deemed incompetent to stand trial, concerns over the discharges from state-operated county treatment facilities, and overall concern for public health, a group of stakeholders was convened by NAMI Minnesota and Mental Health Minnesota to begin researching this issue. The good news is that through this effort, we have determined, it has been determined that Minnesota is eligible for approximately $800,000 in technical assistance from the Nonprofit Council on State Government at no expense to the taxpayer. Members, the bill before you today does a couple of vital things. First, it creates a task force comprised of key stakeholders to come together to study the root cause of the issue and seek proposed solutions. The plan is to return early next year with a report on findings for both immediate and long-range solutions. It also allows us to access the $800,000 in funds from the Nonprofit Council on State Government, whose mission is to aid government in evaluation, analysis, and creating creative solutions for some of our most challenging problems. Members, I want to first also thank my co-author, Representative Zerwas, who we heard from earlier today, as well as Senator Senjin, who is supporting this bill in the Senate. I have beside me Sue Abdelhoven, who is the executive director of NAMI Minnesota, to answer some additional questions.
Okay. Mrs. Abdelhoven, do you have anything you'd like to share?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abdelhoven, NAMI Minnesota. Just a couple things. One is that we are really confused, frankly, as to why this is happening. So if we look around the country, states that also have a more robust mental health system, like Minnesota, so Ohio, Colorado, California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, also are seeing that almost everyone in their state hospital is someone who has been put there who is incompetent to stand trial. And yet what we know is we have more mental health services than ever before. We have more police trained than ever before, and so what is happening? And so we really felt as we started to delve in this in January that we just need to know more. We need to know how people got there into the jail in the first place. Did something happen 3 months ago? Did they lose their insurance? Did they lose their case manager? You know, what really happened? I know that this looks like a long list of people to be involved, but in order to access the technical assistance, these are the people that they have said have to be a part of it. I really think this could be a very exciting endeavor to really figure this out and dig deep and not just come up with something that's kind of surface level that actually won't address this issue. But we absolutely need to make sure that people from a community hospital can get into Anoka when they need it, and it can't just be everyone coming from a jail.
I agree. Absolutely. Just makes some common sense policy in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's a good deal. Do we have anyone else who would like to testify on House File 2069? Not to mention it levers 800K, but that's always a good thing. members, any questions? Chair Liebman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to ask, the $800,000 kind of, you know, got my attention, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that. I'm sorry, I think I just missed it. Like, who, what foundation is that, or who's going to come forward with that, and what are the conditions? And if you could just kind of talk about how that money comes in, because, I mean, obviously this is the policy committee, but there's nothing in the bill that talks about that.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Abdelhoven.
Representative Liebling. So it's the National Council on State Government, and they have a Justice Center. And so it's really their staff time that actually comes out. So it's $800,000 worth of their staff time and expertise. They just finished doing this for the state of Oregon, and there are some things that we can learn from that, but it's pretty intensive. And what we have to do is actually have a letter that's submitted saying, you know, that we're going to put this task force together. It has to include the governor and commissioners and legislative leaders as well. And then once we get the go-ahead from them, there are some other states that are applying as well. So we wanted to move as quickly as we could on this. Then they'll, you know, come out and start the work with us. They can help us figure out what data to look at and things like that.
Chair Liebman.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that. I just wonder how that works with the actually with the bill, because, you know, the bill, and I wouldn't talk about this in this committee, but, you know, we're kind of coming to the end of our ability here, bills even in finance. So this one obviously has to go to finance, and we're going to have to prioritize it if it's going to get heard. And I'm just wondering, it obviously requires an additional appropriation, or does it? I'm just not sure how all that's working and how passing this bill then interacts with our being able to get leverage that money and apply and all that.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Liebman, so in the governor's revised budget last week, it included a small amount for the Department of Human Services, and so that's in there. We were kind of ahead of the game in terms of putting together the legislation because we've been in contact with the State Council. It's possible that we could still get their support without the bill, but we wanted to cross our T's and dot our I's in terms of moving forward with this.
So Madam Chair, thank you. So is this going to be then contingent upon winning the prize, or does the bill stand on its own even if they decide that somebody else gets their assistance?
Mrs. Abner-Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebman, I mean, I would hope we would go forward no matter what, because it is a huge issue facing the department, facing our criminal justice system. Even if we don't get their technical assistance, I think we still need to bring people together, because what we have is just not, it's not doable, it's not sustainable, it doesn't work for the counties, it doesn't work for the people. We need to address this no matter what.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other? Representative Addison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bonner, for bringing this, and Ms. Abner-Holden. It's a public safety issue, too. I mean, there's just so many pieces to it's a quality of care issue. There's just so many pieces. Can you speak to, just so that the committee knows, what's happening right now? Because there's been a change. And also, just so you know, I want to work with you on this for next year, because this is an issue that I've been looking into. For DHS, there was a change, correct? And can you just speak to that so that the committee knows a little bit more about what that looks like?
Mrs. Abner-Holden.
Madam Chair, Representative Edelson. So what happened is in December, the department issued a bulletin saying that if someone no longer needed care at Anoka, even if they weren't not yet competent to stand trial, they would be sent back to their community. And so what that's meant in some places, since we have absolutely zero community competency restoration programs, although they've offered up their manual to do it, some people are going back to jail. And so part of me just says it's kind of a waste of resources to do that, and we've not built up the community to actually do it as well. So that was a change, and some of us did send letters in objecting to that change. But this is why I think that we now have the department on board for kind of looking at this more deeply.
Madam Chair, the committee knows, too, I think that you have the county attorneys that also want to work this on this issue with you, and I'd be happy to work with you. It's an important issue that, honestly, we're failing in right now, and I think that we have to do something. So I appreciate this task force. This is really needed.
And, Madam Chair, just so people know, the Supreme Court also, or District Court now, also has a task force looking at the number of Rule 20s, which is a whole part of this. And their budget asked for $1 million extra dollars to do the psychological evaluations, because the number of Rule 20s has gone up over 11%. Yep. And so that also is, you know, it's impacting many parts of our system. Yep.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else, members? All right. There have been no further discussion. Representative Bonner renews her motion that House File 2069 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 2069 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Ops. Thank you. And that is our last bill for the day, and we are adjourned. Thank you.